I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
I'm Angelie Preston.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We're going to have some real healing. We've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity, and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And welcome to What's Next. This morning, we have a return guest to What's Next, Dr. Lori Quigley. Dr. Quigley, thanks for joining us.
And thank you for inviting me back.
It was a pleasure speaking with you the first time. And, of course, times have changed and positions have changed. The last time we were with you, you were with Madai University, their interim president. Now you're up at Niagara University. What's your role at Niagara right now?
My role right now at Niagara is, after 15 years, I've gone back to the faculty from administration.
Okay.
And some will say I've left the dark side. But I've been brought back as a full professor, tenured, to coordinate the doctoral program in leadership and policy.
Oh, that sounds like a mouthful for that. What does that entail?
It's a wonderful program, very unique in that it is a cross-disciplinary program. So anybody who comes from any field, any discipline, whether it's health sciences, business, profit, not-for-profit, education, arts and sciences, because there's policy and leadership everywhere in every discipline. And so that is our focus, and I have quite a diverse array of students. The program is delivered 100% online, but synchronously, which means I meet with my students every Friday night on Zoom.
Whoa.
For 3 hours. And they Zoom in from as far as Sudan to as close as Niagara Falls. I have another student who comes in from Saskatchewan. And I think the diversity of the students really adds to the conversation and the quality of the program and the experiences that they each undergo going through this particular program. It is a regular research-based PhD program, but the focus, again, is literally leadership and policy, all the policies that are involved at every level, every organizational structure that you can think of. And they all bring a wealth of background experiences as adult learners to the program. And we have faculty that come from different disciplines as well, which is wonderful.
I'm so intrigued by somebody from Sudan, someone from Saskatchewan finding their way to a program at Niagara. Now, again, like you said, it is remote Zoom learning at the same time, but the attachments there, I'm curious about those
connections. Well, before the pandemic, the program was delivered in person, face-to-face. And then, of course, we had the pandemic. They went online. At the time before the pandemic, they already had international students who were attracted to Niagara University. For whatever reason,
okay.
I think it just has a great reputation as one of the three Vincentian universities in the United States. So I would imagine that that's where some of that started and that began. And I think, because of the uniqueness of the program, word just gets out there. And when the pandemic was over, because the distances where the students were coming in from had grown, the faculty and administration decided to maintain the program 100% online. But unlike other online programs, which are delivered asynchronously, which means you never necessarily meet the faculty and,
okay.
your student peers, it is delivered synchronously. So we are there live with the students in class. It's just through a different medium. We're not there in person. We're there through Zoom.
So how does it feel to be back in the classroom then, Dr.
Quigley? I actually love being back in the classroom. That is one unique thing with me, I think. I think when I became a dean at Buffalo State years ago, Management Confidential, which is at that level, not required to teach, but I always taught at least once a year, one class a year. at Russell Sage when I was a dean there, I always made sure that I taught a class just to keep connected to the students. And I think it also helped me with my faculty relationships because they knew that I could still understand what it's like being in the trenches in the classroom. When I became a provost at Medai and also interim, I missed the teaching because you just do not have the time to teach. But I was always appreciative of those faculty who invited me to give a lecture in their class. And now it's just gone back to, you know, full force, getting everything ready in advance. So I had actually my courses assigned to me early last fall so that I could take the fall semester to get ready for the spring semester. So I'm teaching predominantly all research classes.
Oh.
And I love qualitative research. That's what I've been doing, you know, my entire career. So I do teach the advanced level qualitative research, and then I teach introduction to research as well. I love it, though.
You always look like you love everything that you talk about. And one of the things that, of course, we talked about the last time you're here and what we want to get into a little bit more is, of course, not only just your experience, you grew up on Seneca Nation, but also, of course, your scholarly research into it as well. You're going to be going down to, you're going to give Niagara a little bit of a two-week hiatus, huh? And you're going to go down to St. Bonaventure as a visiting professor.
Right, so I was invited by St. Bonaventure administration to serve as the Lena visiting professor. They have an endowed professorship funded by the Lena family and foundation that allows St. Bonaventure to select and identify people who are experts in their fields, their disciplines, whatnot, to share their expertise with students on campus, with faculty on campus, and with the campus community. So that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm actually lecturing in 12 different classes over the next 2 weeks. So I've had to prepare for those. I'm delivering a public lecture that's open to the public at St. Bonaventure down there in Olean on Monday, March 18th. And then again at Jamestown Community College in Jamestown because of their great partnership with St. Bonaventure. And both of those are open to the public. And for those two lectures, I'm focusing primarily on my research on multi-generational trauma from an Indigenous lens because of what happened to our community members and our community to this day as a result of the residential boarding school era.
Yes, the residential boarding school, which if I recall, your
my
mother...
My mother was a survivor of the boarding school, yes. She was forced to live there for 10 years. And I could, you know, as a young woman, you know, years ago, I could still see its impact on our community. And that's really was the impetus for me conducting any research about the boarding schools. I wanted to know what happened and how is it that we're still impacted by that today. And so that's what I've been doing for quite a number of years, in addition to work I do with Indigenous language maintenance and revitalization.
The boarding school, we did another program on that not too long ago, and it is very troubling to know the type of trauma that people who have been removed from the boarding school for decades now still feel.
Yes. I let me give you an example since the last time we talked about this. My mother passed away just before Labor Day in 2022.
Sorry for your loss.
And before that, unfortunately, my family and I had to make the decision to put her in assisted care living because she developed dementia, okay? Hence my work now with the Alzheimer's Association. Mm. What we didn't realize that was happening, that could even happen, that happened to my mother is that the place where she was, which was Absolute Care in Allegheny, New York, which was absolutely wonderful to work with, actually came to us one day and said, "Your mother's telling lies about the staff." I'm like, "Oh my goodness, that's not like my mother." So I talked to her and she tells me one day, "You're not going to believe this, Lori. Last night, those men came and they took me outside the building and threw me against the brick wall." Mm. Well, my first reaction was, what kind of place did we put my mother in? And then the more I talked to her, I began to realize through her dementia, she was reliving all of those negative experiences that she had at the boarding school. So not only did her life begin in an institution, it ended in an institution, but was so unique to her that I think happens to many of our elders who've gone through these experiences and their families. They relived it all over again. And that was the saddest part for me and my family, was to have to witness that and sort of, you know, unpack everything that she was going through again for the second time in her life. And there were days I think that, you know, she was there with us, okay? But then there were days I have to think, okay, where is she now and what is she thinking back on and, you know, what memory is, you know, triggering whatever's happening presently with her. But you can see that multi-generational impact in the way that our community shies away from going to the doctor. I mean, in many cases that I've seen and researched, you know, a lot of the children were treated like guinea pigs in the hospital at Thomas Indian School. They weren't treated very well by the dentists. You know, just the whole word residential is just it's one of those ouch words. And so that whole lack of mistrust is still there. And, you know, the new research now is epigenetics, which tells us that trauma is carried, you know, just above our genes. Okay, that's literally what epigenetics is.
Okay.
And that's the newest field of science, I think, that's out there that I would imagine that many people who are in counseling programs or psychology, you know, clinical psychology programs are doing much more research in that area, because it is a fact that that trauma is carried from generation to generation.
That's it's obviously sad and troubling. And I'm sorry that your mother had to endure that.
Mm-hmm.
Must have been also difficult for you, because you know, you knew a lot of her stories, right?
But I always take, you know, things, you know, what I learned and what I've gone through, and it's helping me now to help the Western New York Alzheimer's Association, because now I serve on their board. I have the experience of being a caretaker of somebody who's gone through dementia. And then I can now be a better advocate for that association, because we are in that era of treatment. There is treatment now, and there's so much more research that has been done now on early intervention. That's one thing I want to talk about with the health sciences students at St. Bonaventure. You know, I've talked to the dean about this, and I said I have many examples that I can provide where the Indian Health Clinic missed so much on my mom's dementia, because it was all masked by other things such as diabetes, you know, heart disease. And we find that that is the case in many marginalized populations in the United States, where the numbers of Alzheimer's outweighs, you know, racial group, you know, those groups than it does other groups. And so I'm learning all this. I'm learning how to be a better advocate just to help families to you know, better navigate the waters, you know, than my family and I were able to do. So to me, it's just always, you know, a matter of giving back.
Right. And that's very gracious of you to take that approach to it. Do you feel, whether it's your mother or anybody else who comes from an underrepresented, marginalized population, that, you know, there needs to be almost maybe more of a drastic approach to kind of sort that out? Like you said, you know, oh, it's diabetes, it's high blood pressure, it's this, it's that. And maybe something could have been done for your mother and others like that. Like
I'm
her?
Not sure if you need a drastic approach. I just think you need better education.
Okay.
There are certain things that may be missing in health sciences programs. Things to consider that if you don't come from that background or that community, that maybe you wouldn't necessarily know. So it's really just, you know, giving broader perspectives, you know, to students who are going through health sciences programs, as an example, or maybe even individuals who work in the health sciences field. Certainly, I've actually done trainings, and I'm not a health science person.
Right.
You know, I have no health background,
okay,
except for what I have studied about multi-generational trauma and its impact and the actual things that you can see in our communities. So I've taken that information, and I've actually done professional development training with the health department staff at the Seneca Nation. And I just never really thought about dementia or Alzheimer's or things that, you know, my family even missed, things that the doctors missed, the healthcare professionals. And so that's just one area that I'm going to be talking about when I'm down at St. Bonaventure as part of the Lena visiting professorship.
What about that, because you're the one in academics. I'm well outside of it now after 40 some years away. Is there a sense that there's a an opening up of understanding and trying of people in those fields who are teaching in classrooms that are they're trying to get that point across?
I definitely think so. It's interesting because the way I gather it, you know, the deans open up to the faculty that somebody is coming. This is who's coming. You know, you're welcome to invite the visiting professor to your class. And 12 faculty stepped up from all different fields, whether it's communications, health sciences, physical education is one class, an education class, a history class, an English class, a Spanish class.
Okay.
So it's really interesting all the different disciplines that I'll whose classes I'll be visiting.
Right.
And then how do you actually kind of fit yourself into the mold of what they're teaching?
Right. And let's
And so basically
that, yeah.
It's just been they had ideas of what they wanted me to speak about. So it's kind of like negotiating, well, okay, I can address that, but I'm addressing all of it from an Indigenous perspective.
Right.
Whether it's multi-generational trauma. I mean, one person wanted me to talk about subtractive bilingualism,
right,
which really doesn't fit Seneca language. So that concept, subtractive bilingualism, means that there are people who believe that students or children who are in a bilingual program where they're learning English, it's going to take away from their native language.
Okay.
And one is going to sacrifice for the other. When I approach Seneca language, and I do an awful lot of work still with the Seneca language teachers, we want our students to be able to be fluent in both. Obviously, someday the hope and desire, the most ideal thing, would be for our children's first language to be Seneca.
Hmm.
It is our heritage language, but we're teaching it as our second language.
Okay.
But we want our children to be successful as multilinguists, and, you know, not just one, but both, because you have to in this country. We just happen to be, you know, within the confines of a country who's very monolingual.
Right.
Which is ironic because e pluribus unum, out of many, there's one, but the many isn't necessarily celebrated.
Wow, that's very profound, Dr. Quigley.
I take too much time to think about these things sometimes.
Well, you've come to the right place to share. I hope you feel like you've come to the right place to share in that regard. The Seneca language, if we could talk about that. We had some folks from Lakeshore High School. They were putting on some special programming. Got into a little bit about language and trying to understand it. You know the language is not easy, right?
It's a difficult language to learn. The grammar and syntax is not like English, all right? It's like a very high level of English, all right? When you're looking at future tense, future, you know, perfect tenses, all these things that actually exist in English, but we don't learn. But not only that, it's just, you know, a lot of it is from the perspective of who's speaking and to whom are they speaking. When you're translating. But at the same time, our worldview is embedded within that language, which essentially means our culture is embedded in that language.
Okay.
The way that we saw things before any European contact is how that language is built. Okay. So I'll use a different language story to explain. So Dr. Richard Little Bear, Cheyenne, at a language conference one time I was speaking with him, and he said they were hosting one of their first immersion camps and they wanted to serve mashed potatoes. There's no word for mashed potatoes in the Cheyenne language.
Okay.
So the best way that they could find a word or a phrase was actually translated from Cheyenne, English into Cheyenne. The English would have been, you know, pounding and beating to death a bunch of potatoes, okay,
right.
Which is mashed potatoes,
right,
all
right? Right,
and he got such a kick out of it, but he explained how they had to go from one perspective of actually pulling apart what is it that we're describing. So that's our worldview, how we would describe things into the language. So there's no word for paper plate, napkin, fork, spoon, and we just didn't have those. And so it's going back to the language and finding the best vocabulary to fit into the way we describe things in English and in our current worldview. And then there's also ceremonial language, which I do not deal with. I leave that to the faith keepers. But I do work an awful lot with the language teachers. That is one of the things when I was in Washington, D.C. last week, advocating on the Hill for legislative appropriations to support legislation that's been passed for native language. Why do we need appropriations? Well, if you look in a school system, for example, if you become a math teacher, social studies teacher, English teacher, whatever, you've got textbooks. You've got all the materials ready there, right there for you. There is no textbook for Seneca language, or for, frankly, for most of the indigenous languages, because we don't have textbook companies who will work with us. It's not financially feasible for them.
Right.
All right. So our teachers are learning Seneca at a higher level. They're improving their fluency. At the same time, they're creating all of their instructional materials. At the same time, they're getting ready to actually teach. So they have that whole extra layer added on to them on their workload in building curriculum. And that's what I'm working with the Seneca language teachers on, is building and constantly refining our curriculum so that it's easier for the teachers to actually go into the classroom, pick up the curriculum, and teach.
Well, you know, like any good scholar, you've definitely intrigued me with some of these comments, and that idea of how the Seneca language reflects a worldview that predated Columbus, and it predated any visitation of white Europeans here on this continent. How about that for you? Is that something that you see that catches you, just as you were talking about it, I can almost see like this sense that there's something very, very special about being able to get attached to that?
I think there is, and I think that it has really grounded me, and I would imagine that the way that I approach any given situation, my leadership abilities and qualities really stem from my background, my native background. Our guy Wio, okay, the teachings of the good mind teach us to live every day with a good mind and a good heart in all we say and do. I try to live by that. That's what our elders have taught us, and they've passed that down orally from generation to generation to generation, and so that would probably summarize my approach to things. And then I think my husband will tease me. I'm married to an Irishman from the Bronx, but he will tease me because we could be driving along somewhere and there's a hawk, there's a deer. How do you see these things? I don't know. Somehow we're taught, and maybe it's the way I grew up, playing down in the woods on the Allegheny Territory. I don't know that I recognize very quickly every element in my environment.
Mm.
And in any given situation, I've had colleagues who have told me, you scan everything before you make a decision. And I think that that's part of the way we were traditionally raised as well, okay, to really think deeply about something before we make any decision. And so there's just so much. I know former students who are doing great research just in food sovereignty. And what does that mean? Going back to our traditional ways of, eating food, whether it's corn, beans, and squash, whether it's going after venison or whatever, it's not fry bread and tacos. Because certainly we didn't have flour, okay?
Right.
And we didn't cook things or fry things, That those are things that were just, given to us by the government.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow, so this is, you've got your work at Niagara, what you're doing, this is going to be a lifelong academic journey or a scholarly journey.
Yeah, it's probably a labor of love, I guess.
Right.
I really do love what I do. I feel very blessed to be able to do the things that I do. I try as best as possible to remain connected to my community, where I grew up. And I think that's also, we're also taught that, we carry everything from our ancestors on our shoulders. And in that carrying that forward, we're also supposed to think seven generations ahead, because everything we do say and do has that impact generationally. And so I think, slow down. My mother used to tell me this when I was younger. Okay. Slow down. All right. Not so fast. You're right. And I think that that's really helped me even in my decision making and probably leadership style, too, is that I really do think deeply about everything before I make decisions. And, just in the way I treat people, the way I teach, the way I work with students, I value, each human that I come in contact with. I just really give credit to my elders for teaching me that.
Do you feel that you see that, though, in other people who also have grown up on the Seneca Nation or other indigenous people you've met from around the country?
Most definitely.
Yeah?
Yeah, definitely. I think those are things that we all share in common. We're not all the same.
No.
You know, right now you have, for example, 574 federally recognized tribes just in the United States. We do have many commonalities, but we have so many things that are strikingly different from one another as well. Everybody tends to lump us all together, you know, but we're not all the same.
But at the same time, as we talk and you mention these types of qualities, I mean, these are, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, marketable qualities. These are qualities that we could all benefit from.
Oh, I think so, definitely. Yeah. So oftentimes, too, in my work with the National Indian Education Association, we talk about educational sovereignty actually begins with us. But we also work to endeavor to teach as many people who want to learn, many school districts who want to learn about our traditional ways, our value systems. We take a look at it from really an assets approach instead of a deficit approach, that our students, you know, no matter what their level of income is, they bring so much into the classroom, you know, that's, you know, you can't, you know, just justify it. Well, it's not worth this much money. No, they may come from poverty, but oh, those kids bring so many gifts in every day. And that's kind of the approach that we take, and that, you know, our elders are considered the wisdom keepers. We rely so much on them to this day for their wisdom and their knowledge, and we respect them for that. And those are things that I see across all tribal nations, whether it's here or in Canada.
Dr. Lori Quigley is our guest on What's Next here on WBFO.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Klein Hand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate. And that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
We're with Dr. Lori Quigley this morning on What's Next on WBFO. So, Dr. Quigley, I guess first and foremost, as you go down to St. Bonaventure as a visiting professor, you had to be encouraged that there are 12 different classes that wanted you to come speak. And I would think that's an encouragement. Is it fair to say, or am I maybe making too much of a judgment here, that maybe there was a time where maybe that much interest wouldn't have been there? Or am I overstating a point there a little bit?
I don't think you're overstating a point, but I do think that you're stating a truth. Okay, I do believe that... over the years, since certainly I was an undergraduate student at St. Bonaventure, to going back and teaching as faculty, to even looking at Bonas now, I think that they have really embraced the notion that, especially with, you know, working with the Seneca Nation, they have really opened their arms to do more than they ever have, that maybe they should have been doing for so many years. Certainly there is a group of dedicated individuals from the Seneca Nation who've begun meeting with individuals from St. Bonaventure, which is a wonderful thing. Bonaventure has started a Native Studies minor. I'm thinking they probably want to develop it into a stronger program. And, you know, we're neighbors. St. Bonaventure is right down the road from the Allegheny Territory. It's kind of in the middle of that and our oil spring territory near Cuba, New York. So,
oh,
I mean, you know, There, yeah, we do have another territory. Nobody actually lives there.
Oh, okay.
We do run a class two casino there.
Okay.
And a gas station.
Cuba. Outside of Cuba.
Right along Cuba Lake.
Oh, okay.
That is our land. It's one of the areas that we've had seems like forever. That and the Allegheny Territory and Cattaraugus Territory. There were other territories that we lost over time for whatever reason. I won't get into that. but definitely, it's right there, right in the middle of St. Bonaventure. So I do think they have done wonderfully in reaching out to the Seneca Nation to really build a strong relationship. And I do think the students are appreciating what they're learning and what they're getting with regard to that particular minor at this point in time. I mean, we have somebody teaching Seneca language to mostly students who are not native. How wonderful is that?
It is wonderful.
It doesn't always have to be German, French, Spanish when you're learning a second language.
That's for sure. So have you got 12 different classes? Are you going to tailor your presentations to these classes? I know you said one is physical education.
So each class, each presentation is tailored to the specific class. So I've never taught a phys ed class. I'm not even sure I've ever taken one at the college level. But the professor has asked me really to talk about the relationship between sport and gender with Seneca. I mean, especially with lacrosse. Lacrosse was always traditionally a sport played by men, males only,
right,
and not women. But now we have women who play, so just talking about that, talking about sport sovereignty, I probably will talk about a little bit of the history of what the Iroquois Nationals, now the Haudenosaunee Nationals, have gone through in lacrosse, and just, playing at that level and traveling, with their Haudenosaunee passports from one country to another. And then because gaming is a sport, I know that they're going to ask me about gaming, too, and its impact on our community.
Right.
And what that means. And so those are things that I am familiar with. Those are also things that I've also had to go back and tweak my own research and scholarship on just to make sure that everything I'm saying is current, is fresh, and is correct, actually. So I try to embed research in everything that I do present to students just because that's what we do in higher education, or that's what we should do.
I was going to say should, yes.
So where I've published in a number of these areas, I do have a lot of that already, but it's just going back and fine-tuning. So that's what I've been doing over the past couple of months since I was invited to serve as the Lenevin visiting professor.
Did you really have to do any new research on Seneca gaming?
No.
I didn't think so. That one we don't. What's the state of Seneca gaming, though, right now, since I have you here? And, of course, you can share your connection if you'd like.
I don't really know exactly where we are, except that we've entered the month of March. And I do know that the negotiations for renewing the compact, which had expired in December, this past December, were extended to this March.
Okay.
I don't know how much closer they are in negotiating, but certainly I think the governor and the state legislator, everybody would be wise to, make a fair compact in the end, because it not only serves to benefit the Seneca Nation, obviously, but it serves to benefit the entire Western New York region economically. And I can't imagine anybody in Western New York would say that we don't need that economic benefit. I can't imagine that people would be happy, if we didn't have the opportunity to offer the incredible class three gaming that we currently offer. I mean, just look at it. I mean, we have vendors that we support, food vendors, linen vendors, vendors for, any kind of supply that you can think of, from building materials to everything that's there. Most of the people who work for Seneca Gaming are not native. We don't have enough Senecas to support the team members that we need to run the quality Class 3 gaming facilities that we have. So we hire quite a number of people. And you know how economics works. You get a paycheck, you know, you can put it in the banks here, sure, but you're spending that money in the Western New York
right.
region. Even Seneca's. I'm not buying my car on the reservation. I'm buying my car over near Williamsville, okay? So I'm adding back
secret.
I'm adding back to the community in Western New York in so many ways. We all are. And I think that, you know, that industry, we definitely have the proof that it's really added so much to the economy in Western New York. And I think it would be a great loss in this state, you know, if we didn't have a fair compact. And that's all we're asking for is a fair compact. Obviously, you know, according to IGRA, you know, which is the federal law that allows us, you know, tribal nations to have Class 3 gaming, you know, it's just that one part of the law that says you need to have a compact with your state. And I've actually visited a number of tribal casinos across the nation, and I've talked with them about their compacts, and it's just been really interesting to see the diversity of the language in those compacts. I mean, California's different. We consider those tribes very fortunate because they're the ones that really rake in quite a bit of money through gaming.
Okay.
It's just the economy is different in California. Whereas if you go to Upper Peninsula, Michigan, it's quite different. And the monies that, you know, the percentage of the money that goes back into the area is so much less.
Hmm.
But the people in the area appreciate having a Class 3 tribal casino there because they know the value of what it brings to the economy of a very rural, poor area. So you kind of have to think out of the box a little bit, you know, as to, you know, how it is beneficial to everybody.
I'll ask this question. You can weigh in whatever way you want to on this, but you know, Governor Hochul's relations with the Seneca Nation, to say the least, at one point were not good. That's probably a nice way of saying it. Is there a hope that perhaps she is maybe her position has evolved a little bit?
Well, one would hope it would evolve, especially because she's from Western New York. Okay, but whether she was or not from Western New York, it shouldn't really matter. She's got to really think about the people of New York State. And there are currently three tribal nations that do have compacts with New York State. And each compact is slightly different.
Hmm.
I will have to say, though, from my perspective, as a Seneca community member, okay, a member of the Seneca Nation, I don't know of many governors who've played very well in the sandbox with us. I don't know why. I really don't know why, okay? I mean, there was an actual report done, you know, at the turn of the 20th century called the Indian Problem in New York State.
Mm.
And sometimes I feel like we're still considered the Indian problem.
Mm.
I don't know why. I honestly don't know why. When we're really here to live side by side, okay, and that was really, if you really look back historically at one of our earliest wampum belts, which is the Goswantha or the Turo, the whole philosophy was this. We can live side by side, each of us carrying our own ways, our own traditions, okay, and respecting and sharing the land in which we live. Unfortunately, one side didn't, you know, get that and didn't understand that we could share and live side by side.
Hmm.
So it really, did it work? But do we still honor that particular treaty belt? Yes, we do. We try to. All right. And so you can look over time where, you know, the Senecas have been fortunate to have been able to have treaties with the federal government, okay, in these arrangements, whereas the Western tribes, the treaty-making period was over by 1850, so many of your Western tribes don't have treaties with the United States like we do, but our sovereignty has been guaranteed to us, you know, forever. You know, you've got the Pickering Treaty, the Canandaigua Treaty, you know, 1794. You could do a whole class and more on just the treaties. And then also the treaties that have been broken. That one in particular, look where I grew up. They built Kinzua Dam. They inundated, flooded out 10,000 of our acres that are guaranteed to us by that treaty. How does that happen? That's the 1960s. It's not like it happened 200 years ago. And those things seem to continue to happen, which is unfortunate.
Does that weigh into the negotiations to a certain extent, a lack of trust? I mean, I would think it would have to be.
I would imagine. But I also think the Senecas, we've gotten a lot better because, we're more educated in the dominant system, okay? you know, we have incredible lawyers, both Seneca and non-Seneca.
And it seems like you're winning the battle of public opinion, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would hope so.
I mean, but it's been, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just been absolutely, you know, I think we have done so much as a gaming corporation for the community. We give away hundreds of thousands of dollars every year to nonprofit organizations that help those individual nonprofit organizations. And I think sometimes that's forgotten as well. We have a donations committee. You know, people, there's a process like any other, you know, foundation, you know, that gives out money. But we give out well over $300,000 a year to this community, okay, as donations.
Right.
So that speaks volumes as well.
I think we could speak gaming all the rest of this program, but I want to get into a couple of these other classes that you're going to be handling at St. Bonaventure. Maybe you want to touch upon, maybe we can give some homework to some of the students you're going to be talking to here. I see you're going to be in sociology, nursing. I mean, right down the line, there's all sorts of different classes that you're going to be talking to. How are you going to adapt to some of those?
Well, some of them I definitely have PowerPoints that I'll reference, and others it's just more of a lecture and a Q&A.
Okay.
I mean, you know, one of the professors who teaches a professional writing communications class asked me to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion in the business environment. Well, I can talk about it from my perspective of having, you know, chaired a major corporation in Western New York, you
right.
know, certainly. And I have no problem with that. And I can certainly talk about, you know, gender equality and, you know, the faculty have asked me to talk about navigating higher ed as a Seneca. There are not many of us in higher education.
Really?
And as far as I know, I'm probably the only Native American who has been a dean, a provost, and a president in higher education in New York State. Certainly when I became a professor, I was the only Native professor at Bonaventure. When I was a professor at Buffalo State, I was the only one first. And then before I moved up into the dean's office, I believe there were maybe three or four of us. But our numbers are very small across the state. We pretty much know who each of us is that's out there. When I was navigating, you know, academia as a professor in my early years, those of us who were Native at the time, we would get together, whether we were teaching at Buff State, UB, Canisius, wherever, because there were so few of us, we would just get together every once in a while just to talk and sort of, you know, give each other some place that we could really talk about what we're going through on our respective campuses. And so I know that I've been asked to talk about that. I've done lectures before on Haudenosaunee women's leadership, past, present, and future. You know, and I really start by our traditional story with Sky Woman, you know. And then I go into the history of Jagongsasa, the mother of all nations, and how she was the first female to have accepted the peacemaker's story, you know, and all of that. And then, you know, how we evolved into a clan system, clan mothers, you know, from Jagongsasa, just all the way through to the present and how, what our women do as far as leaders in our own community. And so it's a different perspective. And that one, I actually use a PowerPoint that's all artwork. Okay,
oh.
That sort of depicts the journey because we have no photographs, okay,
right, of
what Sky Woman looked like. We only have an artist's rendition of what he or she, you know, thought that she might look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I basically use slides of artwork as I talk about that journey of women's leadership. And we are a matriarchal society. We still are a matriarchal society.
Because your clan depends on your mother's.
Yep. So my mother was Wolf Clan. I'm Wolf Clan.
Okay.
Yeah. So the lineage is, you know, really through our mother. And then other than that, it's just, you know, how do we actually, in a history course, it's interesting. The history course is empires and world history.
Oh, my.
Yes, exactly. So I have been specifically asked to provide the indigenous perspective on empire building in the Americas, you know, relationships between indigenous peoples and United States today. You know, and in you know, and recent past.
How much preparation have you done for that one?
So I've done
far?
A little bit of preparation for that. I just want to make sure that the terminology that has been taught to the students, like imperial framework, okay, that I can actually connect those concepts to what I'm going to talk about in modern day relations.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
See, we see ourselves as sovereign nations. We
right.
have a nation-to-nation relationship with the U.S. federal government. Sometimes New York State, and that's where some of the issues are, think that they can negotiate and deal with tribal nations as a nation. You know, the Empire State is still a state.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so I think that that's where some of the conflicts come from. Which is interesting. And
yeah.
then, you know, if you take a look at the history of the loss of land in the Northeast and particularly how it impacted, you know, the Haudenosaunee, the Confederacy, and then, you know, the Senecas as a whole, it was truly that imperialistic thinking. So,
right.
yeah.
Dr. Quigley, we're coming down here. We also have the public presentations that you're going to have as well, one at St. Bonaventure, one at Jamestown or JCC in their campus in Jamestown. What about those presentations? What should we expect?
Those presentations are my way of being able to educate the general public on the boarding school era.
Mm.
And certainly my focus will be Thomas Indian School and my journey towards understanding what happened at Thomas Indian School and its impact today. In one of those, we will be showing the documentary that I was part of. I served as special advisor on the documentary Unseen Tears here in Western New York. And it's really just setting up the background so that attendees for these public lectures understand what they're actually going to see and witness and hopefully feel, you know, viewing that 27-minute documentary. There's a lot packed into 27 minutes. And a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions. We actually created that documentary with Native American Community Services here to use it sort of as a medium to help us heal. Okay.
Okay.
And when we first started showing the documentary at different community venues, we always made sure that we had individuals who were grief counselors and also individuals who were more from traditional aspects of the community, whether they were faith keepers or whomever, because we acknowledge that that documentary stirs up a lot of pain. I mean, certainly I was part of it. I'm in the documentary. I served as an advisor sharing my research with the team that created the documentary. But it took me quite a long time to get to the point that I can actually view the documentary, not completely break down, because it is so close and personal. And it is that way for many of us. I do share that documentary and the information with new school teachers who work with our Seneca children each year, the teachers who've just been newly hired at Silver Creek, Lakeshore, and Gowanda, for them to begin to understand why our community can be the way that it is. And to urge them not to, you know, jump to assumptions about the community, but to create a better understanding of, you know, our history, our past, so that they are a little bit more empathetic when working with our children.
You mentioned how the documentary of the many goals was also to be a healing, I'll use the term vehicle,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better term. Not so much based on the documentary or its impact, but is there healing going on in the Seneca Nation? Does there need to continue to be healing?
I definitely think there is healing going on, and there needs to be more healing going on. I think that, you know, in my 20 years of researching Thomas Indian School, I've definitely seen, you know, some very positive things, not because of me, certainly, but some very positive things that have come out of it. And a lot of it just simply has to do with acknowledging what happened. I mean, you take a look at Canada, who started their own commission way ahead of us,
right.
okay? And it took, you know, President Biden to appoint Deb Haaland, first Native American, member of the cabinet, okay, Secretary of the Interior, to actually begin to do something in this country by establishing the Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition that still has so much work to do. Will this country ever get to the point of an apology? No, I don't think so. And I'm not even quite sure, you know, we need an apology. What I hope will come from all of that is a simple acknowledgement that this is what happened to the indigenous peoples of this land. That they tried to assimilate us and they tried to annihilate us, but in their assimilation, you know, their assimilationist policies of taking children from their families, stripping them from their names, their culture, everything, because they thought we were savages. We're the only ones mentioned, okay, in the Constitution. We are referred to as savages. That language has not been changed. There is no other group of people in this country that has that reference. So if you take a look at the historical, you know, background and a better understanding, and those are the things that are missing from curriculum in our public schools. How come we don't learn that until we're adults?
Right.
How come that's so surprising to adults that I speak with or college students that I speak with? Why didn't they get it before they got to a college classroom?
Any inroads in that regard? Are there, in terms of getting into the curriculum, or are we still, is it still what I learned when I was in fifth grade or whatever it was of New York State history?
And fourth grade. No, yeah. I don't see the improvements are there yet. But again, you know, that's where our United States Constitution gives states rights, individual rights, and there are 50 states. And each state's approach to curriculum is somewhat different, even though, you know, we've had...
It's got to be hugely disappointed that New York State is behind, though, right? I mean, New York State is supposed to be a progressive state.
Yeah, well, so it's a very complex situation. You know, you've got textbook companies who, you know, really have their pockets in New York State. Mm. They make an awful lot of money. And to go and change curriculum costs you an awful lot of money because that means you've got to change the textbooks too. I mean, there are so many different variables to consider that we probably don't have time in this, you know, short interview.
Your sense of timing is remarkable, Dr. Quigley, because we are getting down to that. But that is, just a thought though, I mean, is technology in any way maybe breaking down that some of those barriers a little bit, that there are more accessible opportunities from a digital standpoint? I mean, is there any hope in that, or is that, you know, kind of piecemeal right now?
I definitely think there is, you know. But then again, you know, things that we fear is stealing intellectual property, stealing our knowledge, and, you know, by a company saying that, you know, we'll produce this for you, but if we do this, we own it.
Ooh.
And those are some issues that we've had to deal with, especially even in the language work that we do. We've actually had companies say, we'll come and produce this, we'll do this and this and this for you, but then we own the intellectual rights to that. And we're like, no, we've had so much taken from us, and so much of our intellectual rights are still housed in the Smithsonian, are still housed in the New York State Museum because they haven't been properly repatriated back to the tribal nations, you know, where these things were taken from. There's a lot.
Yes.
We could go on and, you know, discuss a number of these things, it seems like forever, but I do think that museums especially have become such great allies where they are beginning to create wonderful materials, you know, in hard copy and in digital form that teachers can, you know, latch onto and use in their curriculum. So certainly technology can be an incredibly great instructional tool. It's just really helping the teachers to find out where the good and appropriate materials are located.
So again, resources needed for that to make sure that takes place for sure. And then just in our final minute here, I mean, like you said, there's so much to learn. Yeah, but it's just a word of encouragement to our listening audience to follow this because, I've been lucky enough now to have some very informative guests here who've given me both reading material and also just good conversation. It's a topic. I mean, there's a lot of sadness, of course, in talking about what's happened to indigenous populations, but there's much more to it than that.
I think we're making incredible strides. I mean, look at the Seneca Nation. We have a relatively brand new cultural center museum We invite the public down anytime they want to come and learn about us. We give private tours. We give group tours. You can walk through it on your own. And it's just an hour's drive south of Buffalo.
Right there in Salamanca,
right?
So why not?
Right there in Salamanca. We just have so many offerings that are, you know, here in, you know, even in the Buffalo and Niagara community, where we invite people to come and learn about us. We invite them to, even at the Seneca Nation. It seems that the Senecas, they will host different cultural events at, you know, their three tribal casinos, open to the public, to come and see, you know, who we are, what our traditions are, who we are today. So, I think that just don't be afraid. We accept you as our neighbor. We want to be neighbors. We would love for you to learn as much as you can about us, and we will help you in that endeavor.
Well, thank you for doing just that this hour. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Dr. Lori Quigley with us now of Niagara University, and is going to be down at St. Bonaventure. As their visiting professor here for a couple of weeks as well. And, you know, all these different things that you brought up, you've got to come back and talk about them some more. How does that sound?
I definitely will. Thank you.
We'll let you lay out the curriculum before you come in. How does that sound? Just to prepare. Dr. Lori Quigley is our guest here on What's Next. This is What's Next on WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.